Elise Glink joins us from Think Glink Media. How are you, Elise? Welcome back.
Oh, nice to be here, John. Things are good.
Are they?
Well, it depends. Are you a CEO of a publicly traded company? Then things might be really good for you. In fact, it's for everybody else, you know, wage growth is up this year. That was a good thing. But for CEOs, one of the things that we're just learning is just how good it is. This year, companies must disclose how much the CEO's stock holdings increase when the market rises. So the stock market has been going up, and there are a whole bunch of companies that are earning more than the CEO is earning more than $150 million a year.
Because the company compensates them in part with stock, and as the stock goes up, so too do their fortunes.
Right. That's one of the things that's going on with Elon Musk right now. You know, he's trying again to get his eye-popping, like, $48 billion pay increase passed. But stockholders are concerned. And in fact, one of the California big pension funds that owns quite a lot of Tesla is really concerned about that pay package. And a lot of it is based in stock. And the stock goes up, the stock goes down. But in any way, you know, getting more than, say, $6 billion as part of your annual pay package feels excessive to some people.
What do you think about that?
I think it's excessive. I really do. And I do think that Elon Musk is one of the, you know, great geniuses of our time. And the sheer breadth of companies that he's been able to start and grow. I mean, SpaceX to Tesla to, I don't know, there's been a bunch of other ones that
The Boring Company.
A
company that's planting chips in people's brains.
Yeah,
folks who can't otherwise move their limbs might be able to think to move their limbs.
Yeah, it's impressive.
But I think what's offensive to some people is, if not the number itself, the disparity between the average worker and the CEO, even ones that aren't getting billion-dollar paychecks.
Yeah, I think that's right. So when you look at the average annual wage in last year, it was $65,470, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics. And at that wage, it would take almost 450 years for the typical American worker to earn as much as the middle-of-the-road chief executive on this list of the $150 million a year club. And that is, you know, very, very concerning. The person who made the most money last year was a guy named Winkelried of TGP, and his compensation was almost $200 million just for the year.
John Winkelried of TPG, which is a private equity company. Some of these companies, it's weird. You think if they were that successful, they could pay an executive that much, I would have heard about them. I don't know about TPG. I've heard of the Carlyle Group. I've heard of some of these other companies. But what do you say to the people, though, that say, well, if the stock does poorly, then the executive doesn't get this? I mean, it's compensation commensurate with their performance.
It is, and there's certainly a case to be made that you should be well rewarded for the good that you bring. But for a lot of these employees, or I should say these CEOs, they have minimums that they get. They get stock grants. They get repriced options. So let's say the stock goes down and then the company reprices their options. So they still get, you know, maybe they get 25, 30 or 40 million instead of 150 million. I'd take that pay package.
Yeah. I also think that some of these people that are getting $150 million a year are doing so because the stock rose, because they did a good job, but also because the rising tide is lifting a lot of boats. I will acknowledge that the markets are performing pretty well these days, oftentimes because of just a select number of stocks. Not every company that's publicly traded is having a banner year. But I also think that some of these guys just are lucky to be sitting in that seat at a time when the markets are up.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think they also have people who are very adept at negotiating these kinds of contracts, and they are able to put in a lot of other kinds of benefits that, you know, typical rank and file don't actually get. So I think, you know, when you look at how much people are earning, one of the things that's, you know, nice and good news for just sort of everybody is that hiring was really robust, far more than it was expected. We got that news on Friday, up 272,000 jobs, and we saw wages increase about 4.1% in May,
yeah,
which also looked pretty good.
We're talking to Elise Glink. We're talking about CEO executive pay, which is, I don't have the average here, but there's a club of people who made $150 million in stock options last year when the average American worker wage was $65,470. Anything else to say about that before we move on?
Well, no, just that if you look over the last, since 2019, so the last 5 years of wage growth, except for 2022, when inflation went, you know, bananas, we've really seen wage growth above where the cost of inflation is. And that was true this month as well, where, you know, you saw wages go up about 4.1%, whereas inflation's at 3.4%. So that 1.5%-ish, or I guess it's 0.5%, it doesn't feel like a whole lot when you say it that way, but the average American worker is making some gains, and that's nice to see.
The Fed can't knock that number down to what they want it to, though, can they?
Not yet. It is proving sticky. And, you know, really, it's a kind of good news, bad news situation, right? It would be better if inflation came down just a little bit more. On the other hand, wow, what a strong economy we have. I mean, we are the envy of Europe. We're the envy of Asia. We're really, the United States is really powered ahead, where over in England, for example, in the United Kingdom, Britain has just lowered its interest rates for the first time in 5 years because their economy isn't doing very well. So it's kind of interesting that we're in this good news, bad news situation.
You know, we have the market analysts, and you're not exactly that. I mean, we value your opinion on these things, but you're not a trader, are you? You don't have a Series 7, do you?
No, I do not. I do not trade at all. I, as you know, I've just written a whole bunch of books about this stuff.
Well, so I'm just wondering where you are on the line then. I was drawing it previously at maybe 3 Fed interest rate cuts, and now I've moved it to 1.5. Are you above or below 1.5?
1.5 Fed cuts? How do you get to a half of a cut?
Well, now you've got to pick one. Are you above or below that line? Are you above or below that line?
I think we're going to have one interest rate cut this year later. And remember, when you and I talked about this in December, the Federal Reserve was talking about 3 or 4 interest rate cuts. And because they just can't seem to slow down the economy enough, I think they're going to leave interest rates where they are.
What's your thought about home sales then as a result of all of this?
Well, the home sale problem is really a problem of supply. It's not a problem. Demand is certainly there, even with interest rates as high as it is. Demand would be even higher if interest rates were lower, right? We've got an affordability issue right now. So if you don't have more things on the market, you're not going to be able to sell more no matter what the demand is, right? That just kind of stalls things out.
Really, but your opinion is that the problem with the housing market is less interest rates than it is supply?
100%.
Huh. I don't know. Maybe that's almost encouraging. That is, because to me, one of the collateral damages for the Fed's action or inaction has been the real estate market. But you really don't think that's it?
I don't think that's it. I mean, if you look at where the jobs were for May, 21,000 of them went into construction. But when you look at the number of houses being built, there's just simply not enough homes being built right now to deal with the demand. And remember, we're still short like 6, 7, 8 million homes. That number's growing because, you know, we're not actually producing enough homes even to meet the demand that's there. So I think until we start producing homes at a much greater level, we're going to see tremendous demand and we're going to see prices continue to go up.
Elise Glink is the owner of Think Link Media and Best Money Moves. Click on thinklink.com. Thanks a lot, Elise.
Hey, anytime, John.
Jim Dahlke is too, the national editor at American Inno. You can always click on ChicagoInno.com. Jim, welcome back to the show.
Hey, John. Thanks for having me. Great to be here.
A couple of stories I want to spend a little time on with you. First of all, talk to me about Workbox. What is Workbox?
Yeah, Workbox is a Chicago company. They're a startup, and they are a co-working company. So they create or operate co-working locations in Chicago and other cities throughout the U.S. And they are in the news as of the other week. They just raised a brand new round of funding, $17.5 million for Workbox here. It's an interesting fundraise for a company in an interesting industry. Right now, obviously, there's a lot of talk about WeWork as it's continuing its way through bankruptcy and as it's struggled over the years with its co-working model. And, you know, the office, you know, occupancy rates remain, you know, well below pandemic levels. But, you know, WeWork Workbox really believes that it's fitting a really interesting role in the space and allowing companies to have this flexible workspace. So this new funding is going to help it open up new locations in new cities across the country. And now they've raised more than $25 million to date here. So, you know, the founder of Workbox told us that they really believe that flexible office space really has, you know, this chance to drive recovery in the office real estate market moving forward. And, you know, they think that they're really bullish here on flexible workspace. So, you know, they you know, long gone are the days of, you know, necessarily having a 50,000 square foot headquarters. And they believe the future of office real estate is kind of more of this flexible workspace. So a nice little fundraise for a Chicago startup, Workbox.
WeWork was maybe a one-off. Was that kind of anomalous just because of the mercurial owner of the company or founder of the company? I wonder what to make of this category. Is it a viable thing? Because the most famous one of them all went bust.
That's true. And WeWork, you know, certainly had some problems, you know, on its own. You know, it made some interesting bets. It even at one point invested, you know, some of its money into an indoor wave pool maker. So, like, I think they maybe got a little unorganized or kind of lost sight of the goal here. But, you know, I think flexible office space today, you know, is important. I mean, you talk to, you know, pretty much every major company, you know, that they believe in in-person connections, and maybe they don't necessarily believe in, you know, doubling down on the traditional long-term lease space. But, you know, having that flexible workspace for, you know, occasional in-person meetings, occasional, you know, client meetings where you're bringing somebody in from out of town, and you need an office space to work, this flexible workspace really provides that. And so, you know, I don't think flexible workspace, I don't think co-working is going away anytime soon.
Well, I wonder what that would mean for employees who are working at home and don't want to go into the office anymore. We're not talking about them, are we?
No. And so, I mean, it's really kind of this hybrid approach that companies are taking. And so, yeah, some employees are going to be completely remote, but, you know, you may need a company on site, right? So we're bringing everybody in maybe once a week or once a month or once a quarter or once a year, or however you define that. And some of these employees are going to be in the office maybe a couple times a week or more because that works for them. And for some employees, they want to be completely remote. And if that's what, you know, your company is allowing your employees
right
to do. Like,
but if it was a company that has existed for a while, then when we want you to all come in and we're going to have a meeting, you would do it at the company headquarters. We don't need this alternative site. So I'm wondering who the market is right now for this alternative site for, you know, this WeWork type space.
Yeah, for Workbox, it's really, you know, they're targeting these, you know, young companies, so up-and-coming kind of early stage and growth stage businesses. So these aren't exactly your Fortune 500s, right? These are your companies of, you know, 10, 15, 20 people to start that are still kind of trying to define what their workspace looks like. And so having, you know, some flexibility, having a hybrid option, it gives them that ease of flexibility to get the type of workplace environment that they're looking for, whether it's in person or remote.
Will they have a kitchen and a ping pong table and recreational areas at these places? Do they have some of these Workbox locations up and running?
Yeah, that's right. So they're in several locations across Chicago. So yes, this is a place that's already up and going. And yeah, those amenities are important. I mean, you know, having a kitchen stocked full of food, having a little recreation space. You know, I think that's important to workers who are getting back into the office today, right? And so, yes, that's a big piece of the puzzle here for Workbox and pretty much every co-working operator.
But you said something that makes me think about another story that we're looking at today, and that is fractional executives. I don't know if they're going to come into the corporate headquarters, or maybe if I'm a relatively new company, I don't have the space or the money for a full-time CEO. Is that what a fractional executive is, by the way?
That's right. So, you know, we had a story recently really kind of looking at, you know, experts in the startup space are telling us that, you know, these fractional executives is, you know, one kind of trend that's really spreading like wildfire throughout startup land. You know, we talk about gig work a lot over the last several years, you know, freelance work, and it, believe it or not, it's even applicable to the C-suite. And so what these fractional executives are doing is, you know, kind of coming in on a part-time basis. So think about a fractional CMO or fractional CFO. It allows a startup to bring in a seasoned vet, a seasoned executive to come in and help with the books if we're a CFO, for example, or help with some marketing initiatives. But it's at a much cheaper rate than if you were to hire a full-time CMO. It's really kind of a 180 from what we saw in late 2020, early 2021, when startups were raising money like crazy, and it was just hire, grow, bring in as many full-time folks as possible. Well, you know, as we've talked about often, you know, the funding environment has changed. The money is harder to come by, and every startup is looking at their runway and trying to, you know, extend it as long as possible and not overspend. And one way they're doing that is these fractional executives, these fractional C-suite folks who can come in on a part-time basis and really provide a lot of insight. And what you're able to get from a startup side is you're able to get some really quality talent because it works, you know, really well on the talent side as well for these fractional executives. You know, they have a lot of flexibility now by coming in and helping a company part-time.
I can understand your need for maybe a CFO if that wasn't your skill space, if you, say, have your own company. But who's hiring the CEO if not the CEO? I mean, if it's your company, you're the CEO, right?
Yeah, you're probably seeing not as many fractional CEOs, but really more of like these CMOs, like these chief marketing officers, like we mentioned, the financial officer as well. And so kind of rounding out your C-suite with these fractional C-suite executives is really one way to kind of bring in some really top-tier talent without really having to overpay. So, and it allows some flexibility on the startup side too, right? You bring in, you know, a fractional CFO for, you know, 6 months, you know, a year, and maybe if it, you know, if the relationship doesn't work out, it's not, you know, a big deal, right? This is already a fractional position. And so, you know, it allows flexibility on both sides of the table.
Got that. And then, by the way, we talked to Mike LaVitola, the executive chairman of Foxtrot, a little while ago today. Did you guys do a story about him as well?
Yeah, so, I mean, it's great, obviously, for Foxtrot that they're going to be reopening some of their stores, including some in Chicago. I think for lots of folks in the city, you know, Foxtrot was a place that, you know, you went to grab a drink, to grab some coffee, to grab some snacks, and I think many in Chicago were certainly confused and upset that their local coffee shop was closing down. So it's great news for Foxtrot that they're reopening and they're going to find some new life here. I mean, this was a business that raised, you know, over $100 million in funding over the years as they looked, you know, to bring their, you know, kind of corner store of the future concept to more locations in Chicago and across the country. And so certainly it was a shocking, abrupt news when the news came out that they were closing their doors, but yeah. Certainly encouraging for the owner there that they're going to reopen a few of them.
Yeah, he said in 6 to 8 weeks, and most of the Chicago brick-and-mortar locations he thinks will come back. Just one last question about that whole story, though, because they declared bankruptcy, or the parent company did, that owned Foxtrot after he had departed. But how unusual is it for somebody else to come in and give him a clean slate like this? Lucky for them, is that how it usually goes, or how often does that happen?
I think this is certainly an unusual story. You know, I think you do occasionally hear of, you know, the stories of founders kind of coming back in after a startup kind of goes belly up. You almost saw this with WeWork. We just were talking about WeWork. The sort of embattled founder of WeWork was rumored to have be interested in coming back in and purchasing up, you know, some WeWork assets himself. And so, you know, kind of this story of the founder who's left the business coming back in and kind of playing hero to save the day is definitely one we've heard you know, over the years. But the specific scenario with Foxtrot is definitely an unusual one, but certainly great news that they're going to spin up some new stores.
Good to talk to you as always. Thanks for your time, Jim.
Thanks, John.
That's Jim Dahlke. Let's continue on the Wintrust Business Lunch with a business update with Ryan Burrow.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute. The Sun-Times is reporting the average cost for a hotel room during the city's top three events, the DNC, the NASCAR Chicago Street Race, and Lollapalooza, will be about $535 a night, with the most expensive being during the August DNC. The Ravinia Festival Association, the music organization which operates the concert and entertainment venue in Highland Park, has updated its federal lawsuit against Ravinia Brewing Company. The festival claims the brewing company is falsely implying a relationship. Ravinia Festival has also filed a petition with the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office requesting cancellation of Ravinia Brewing Company's registered trademark. And Illinois State Treasurer Michael Frerich's office announced Monday there will be an online auction for unclaimed property next week. Some of the hundreds of items include a 14-karat gold charm bracelet, a 1783 Spanish milled dollar with certificate, and a 1997 U.S. quarter-ounce platinum-proof coin. To participate, you can register at ibid.illinois.gov. That's your Wintrust Business Minute. I'm Ryan Burrow.
We've got your business of food with Steve Alexander.
Yeah, thank you. And let's go out to the farm, see what's going on.
We're baling hay.
That's a farmer near Pontiac, Illinois, who, along with baling hay for his dairy cows, is celebrating June Dairy Month by giving away milk to Illinois food banks. More about that after I thank the Chevy Silverado and ChevyDriveChicago.com for sponsoring us today. There has never been a better time to put a Silverado in your toolbox. And if you were to drive your Silverado south from Chicago along I-55, you'd come across this fella.
Donald Mackinson. I'm a dairy farmer, Pontiac, Illinois.
Don and his family milk 150 cows.
Ayrshires and Holsteins.
And they raise crops.
Yeah, we got corn, soybeans, wheat, and alfalfa.
And in his spare time, Don is president of the Illinois Milk Producers Association and serves on the Prairie Farms Co-op Board of Directors. And hundreds of Illinois dairy farmers like Don donated a bunch of milk to the Northern Illinois Food Bank, the Central Illinois Food Bank, and the Eastern Illinois Food Bank.
Over 17,500 pounds of dairy products.
That translates into more than 34,000 servings of milk.
That sounds good, doesn't it? That 34,000 servings?
Yes, it does. And well done, Illinois dairy farmers. And a tip of hat, too, to the State Soybean and Corn Growers Associations who chipped in. The Illinois Farm Bureau, too. The food bank people say dairy products are among the most desired by their customers.
We have one of the best and safest products there is out there on the market.
And how is the dairy farming business these days, Don? I know it's often feast or famine, make or break.
Right now, we're kind of in the middle. We're doing okay.
Still, there are fewer dairy farms every year.
I think there's 23 farms less at our last board meeting in May as what there was a year ago.
One more thing, Don. The handful of bird flu cases that have popped up in dairy cows and a few humans who worked with the cows, is that a concern here?
We're watching it very closely. I know Illinois is a lot better off than Michigan and some of the other states.
And the dairy folks are always testing,
because we want to make sure the consumer knows we are producing one of the best products there is.
Don Mackinson, president of the Illinois Milk Producers, part of a long-standing family farm.
My great-grandpa bought ground back in 1865. My son Matthew and my brother Roy are in partnership with me, and I'm looking forward to the day that my six grandkids take over.
And it's right there along I-55 at mile marker 203.
Yep, honk when you go by.
And from the dairy farm to your belly, today's National Black Cow Day. I think some of us call that a root beer float. And it's National Egg Roll Day. I'm Steve Alexander. That's the Business of Food on 720 WGN.
Or visit Chicago, for that matter. Here's Chef Max Robbins, who is the culinary director for NASCAR weekend. Yeah, NASCAR's coming to town. We all know that. That's the deal we've made, and let's do it right if we're going to do it. Now, what are we going to serve them? What's the food scene going to be? So the culinary director for NASCAR's weekend is Max Robbins, who's with Let Us Entertain You. Chef, welcome to WGN.
Thank you so much for having me.
So what do you do when you don't do this? This sounds like another responsibility for you. What were you doing before you were worrying about NASCAR?
Yeah, so first of all, really excited to be a part of NASCAR and a part of this weekend and a part of Chicago. The rest of my year, I work on different concepts throughout the city. As you know, Let Us Entertain You has a number of restaurants throughout the city. So work on menus, team building, different things, support different restaurants, kind of wherever I can be.
The Chicago Straight Race weekend is July 6th and 7th. So it's going to be, and if it's Let Us Entertain You, that's a whole host of restaurants. So my understanding is there'll be different restaurant offerings from your various locations at various places along the course. Is that right?
Absolutely. So there'll be two different kind of distinctions between the food offerings. So to GA ticket holders, general admission ticket holders, will showcase a number of our concepts, a number of our food. And then in the different VIP areas, that'll have like an all-you-can-eat catering option. That'll also feature some of our restaurants as well.
I see. And will you be the exclusive food vendor then there, or am I going to get a generic hot dog from Acme Hot Dog Company?
So nothing we're going to do is generic. Just like, you know, nothing in Chicago is generic. Chicago is a world-class city, so we really want to showcase why we're one of the best food cities in the world. So in addition to the Let Us Entertain You restaurants, we've partnered with a number of local favorites, like Vienna Beef, like Lou Malnati's, like Garrett's Popcorn. And then we also have a number of local restaurants who are kind of at the forefront of Chicago dining that we also wanted to bring in and showcase, like Lexington Betty's Smokehouse and Bronzeville Winery.
This sounds like a logistical nightmare. Is it? I mean, think about that, preparing great food and having it hot and ready to go all around a NASCAR race course.
Absolutely. Well, I think if people can figure out how to drive however many miles an hour over and over, we could try to get food hot. You know what I mean? So yeah. We're fortunate, just like we've chosen great partners, in our food. We have a lot of partners that we work with, a lot of different production companies that we work with to make sure that we're really at the having the best kitchen equipment, having the best staff, having the best planning. So we're really confident. You know, last year was the first year that NASCAR ever put on a street race, and we were fortunate to provide the food and host. So this coming into year two, we feel like we've made even more improvements and continue to put out a world-class product.
I like the idea that you guys are doing it because we know and trust and love Let Us Entertain You food. So if I'm going to get something and it's you or one of these Malnati's, hooray, you know, it just sounds more Chicago-centric that way, doesn't it?
Exactly, and I think that's the idea. So Let Us Entertain You restaurants, you know, has been at the front of Chicago dining scene for over 50 years, serving world-class food and hospitalities to countless locals and visitors, and we wanted this to be representative of that. So we feel like whether you are an in-town guest coming in who can pick up food from one of your favorite restaurants, maybe you're hosting friends, or you're a visitor coming to enjoy our city in the summer, which everyone knows is the best time of year and best place to be, you can get something that is representative of a stop that you'd want to make if you weren't at this festival, if you were going out to eat in a restaurant. And that's what we really wanted to do, is bring restaurant level dining to, the park area.
We got to wrap this up, but I just want to mention this. The Skyline is a new 3-level elevated structure overlooking Pitt Row that'll provide guests an unparalleled 360-degree sight line of the park and the street course. RPM Restaurants will offer a premier all-inclusive menu special to guests at that Skyline location, including signature pasta station from RPM Italian, fresh salad, shrimp cocktail, all-natural grilled beef tenderloin, and more, plus barbecue options and hot dogs and stuff like that. Now I do want to go. Chef, it's good to talk to you. Good luck, and have a great weekend.
Thanks so much for having you. Hope to see you out there.
Chef Max Robbins from Let Us Entertain You.